could be sweeter than my sweetie when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll continue reading from Growing Up with Chapel Hill, The Village, from 1901 to 1925. By Jane Toy Coolidge. Continuing with Chapter 10, Growing Pains. In 1914, Chapel Hill, along with the rest of the nation, was shaken by the outbreak of the war. Many faculty families had traveled abroad and had close ties in various European countries. For them, the impact of the Holocaust was especially great, and feeling ran high. But there was no great change in the community's way of life until the Lusitania was sunk and Wilson declared war. Then everybody plunged into action, working for the Red Cross, eating meatless, sweetless meals, knitting socks and mufflers, and planting victory gardens. Our family rolled up its sleeves and joined enthusiastically in all these efforts, and the thought that our father's career as a German teacher might place us in an embarrassing position never occurred to us. We had sad thoughts of friends in Germany, but we were staunch Americans. Not until years had passed, and I heard how Germans living in America and other persons even remotely connected with the enemy country were harshly treated during the war, did I realize that our immunity from such treatment was rather remarkable. Never by the slightest hint, word, or deed on the part of our neighbors were we made uncomfortable. I suppose the number of students in my father's classes decreased, but I don't think the study of the language was given up. He continued to teach, and, though I am not sure of it, he may have devoted some of his time to French. The reason he suffered no embarrassment or indignity was, I believe, the fact that, for 30 years, he had been a loved and respected member of the community. There was no question of his loyalty to the United States, or of his high integrity. My mother, too, was loved and esteemed, and it is good to look back and realize that no cloud of misunderstanding marred these difficult days. On the campus, the Students' Army Training Corps paraded in khaki when they weren't drilling on the athletic field. Among the officers assigned to train the recruits was a dashingly handsome Canadian captain whose charm played havoc with feminine hearts, including that of the wife of a young professor. Or maybe she played havoc with his. Tongues wagged, but life went on. There were casualties, of course, the one I remember best being a freshman, Jack Cranmer, in the SATC, whose death from sudden illness was attributed to the rigors of the training program. He was accorded full military honors. A guard of honor escorted the funeral procession as it left town, pausing for an impressive moment at the top of Stroud's Hill while the bugler sounded taps. A later casualty was President Edward Kidder Graham, who died in the influenza pandemic of 1918. This was indeed a tragedy, for it robbed the university of a leader who had just entered upon a career of brilliant promise. The college community, the town, and the state were stricken with a sense of irreparable loss. Dean Marvin H. Stacy was named acting president, to be succeeded by Harry Woodburn Chase. Chapter 11. Hail St. Mary's. While the war in Europe was changing life on both sides of the Atlantic, my small world experienced a transformation all its own. I went away to boarding school. From the time of its founding in 1842, St. Mary's School in Raleigh had offered academic, religious, and social instruction to young ladies in the Carolinas and neighboring states. The term young ladies is used advisedly, for students came from homes where manners were stressed almost as much as morals, and at St. Mary's, though under the aegis of the Episcopal Church, devotion to morals was of paramount importance, emphasis on manners was almost as great. Girls were enrolled here to learn the niceties of behavior that would enable them to shine in the best society, to receive religious training that would make them devoted churchwomen, to pick up a modest education, and to make friends of their own kind. Friendships so formed were an important feature of school life, and lasted from generation to generation. My mother had been graduated in 1886, and when the time came for me to enter St. Mary's in 1917, she and a classmate arranged for their daughters to room together. Raleigh is just 30 miles from Chapel Hill, but getting there in those days was a major undertaking. Advance preparations were like those for an African safari, entailing the purchase of new clothes, sheets, towels, and blankets, with a trunk big enough to hold them all. Then name tapes had to be sewed on everything. At last, the trunk straps were pulled into place and fastened tight, the key turned in the lock, and the trunk, which seemed to weigh a ton, was loaded on the dray headed for the station. Then, dressed in a stiff, new, dark serge suit worn with fine disregard of the September heat, I was ready to start. A group of high school friends came to see me off with farewells made tearful by sympathy or envy, I couldn't tell which. In Durham, I joined my prospective roommate, Nina, and her mother, Mrs. Cooper, who went with us on the train to Raleigh and deposited us at St. Mary's. She was an amiable and sprightly lady whose large family, there were 9 children, seemed not to weigh her down in the least. Her curly hair was coiled into a pointed knot on top of her head, and oftener than not there was a rosebud tucked into it. She saw to it that Nina and I were settled in a small, bare room on the third floor, gave us a single parting admonition, "Try to keep your dresser drawers shut, it makes the room look nice," and departed. St. Mary's had 200 students, an impressive number to me after our tiny school in Chapel Hill. Classes were small, and most instruction sound, with emphasis on fundamentals and no frills. Nina and I were freshmen, and had most of our classes together. She was tall and slender, and good at all sports, while I, thanks to Maud Minish's teaching, could hold my own on the basketball court. Athletics were intramural, with the student body divided into 2 factions, the Sigmas, S for Saint, and the Mus, M for Marys, between whom rivalry was intense. Nina and I became Sigmas, and qualified for the basketball squad. There were pre-game pep rallies, with songs and cheers, and yells so filled with light-hearted enthusiasm that I was carried away by the spirit of joyful fellowship. One song floated across the yard on a crisp fall afternoon and captured for me the thrill of this new experience. "Sigma girls are high-minded. Believe to my soul they're double-jointed. They play ball and don't mind it all day long." I can hear it still. The next year I was to contribute a song of my own to these celebrations, and my heart throbbed with pride as my companions sang, "The Sigma girls have got the pep. Bum, bum, and a little bit more. We'll teach the Mus to watch their step. Bum, bum, and a little bit more. At every game and every meet, we're always sure to score. We'll give the Mus what's coming to them. Bum, bum, and a little bit more." Not even a fond author could hail this as immortal verse, but the sound of those words, chanted by my fellow Sigmas in the crowded gym, thrilled me more than the acceptance by the school magazine of my more serious literary efforts. The Mus, not to be confused with the Mu Athletic Association, was the name of our student journal published every month, and also of the yearbook which appeared in May. Both of these were sponsored by the Mus Club, a highly prestigious organization. Besides being responsible for these publications, the Muse Club controlled practically all extracurricular activities in the school. Entertainments and celebrations of all kinds, special projects, and regular programs were planned and carried out by this group of leaders, and the club set the tone of the atmosphere that prevailed in the student body. The Muse Club had been developed and was controlled by its faculty advisor, Mr. Cruikshank, whose official title, Business Manager of St. Mary's, came nowhere near describing his position in the school. For Ernest Cruikshank managed not only the institution's finances, but just about everything that went on in it. He knew what was happening inside and out, and there were few things in which he did not have a major part. I think he cared passionately about young people and wanted to lead them towards sound and worthwhile development. In the Muse Club, he had an ideal instrument for this purpose, and he made the most of it. If, in so doing, he created an elite corps of privileged persons, he was following procedures common in society at large, and the net result was good for the students and the school. He was respected by everybody and loved by those close to him, for he had the gift of inspiring complete allegiance. A tall, stooped, Ichabod Crane of a man, he looked as if he might break in two under strain, and he was apt to stutter when carried away by an idea. He advised the Muse Club in planning its parties down to the last detail, and one of his pronouncements remains with me still. Make your entertainment so interesting and such fun that refreshments take second place. But he saw that we had good refreshments, too. The head of St. Mary's was the rector, who, besides serving as president, was in charge of the religious life of the school. This meant conducting morning and evening prayers in the chapel every day, with longer services on Sunday and Bible classes during the week. When I came to St. Mary's in September 1917, Dr. George W. Lay was rector, and second in command was Miss Lucy G. Hester, the lady principal. This title, a relic of bygone days, well described her responsibility for maintaining discipline and fostering ladylike behavior, and Miss Hester took these duties seriously. As punishment for certain common offenses, she prescribed the memorizing of the 51st Psalm, and she would sit by her desk, stern and unbending in a dark purple dress, while the offenders stood before her and declaimed, "Have mercy upon me, O God, after thy great goodness. According to the multitude of thy mercies, do away mine offenses. Wash me thoroughly of my wickedness, and cleanse me from my sin," and so on to the end. On one occasion, the entire student body was convicted of noisiness in assembly, and the penitential verses assigned to all 200 girls. If Miss Hester did not already know that psalm by heart, by the time the sentence was carried out, its words must have been engraved upon her memory. In Bible class, we had to learn another religious verse, an extremely long one, which began, "In Genesis, the world was made by God's creative hand. In Exodus, the Hebrews marched to gain the promised land. Leviticus contains the law, holy and just and good. Numbers records the tribes enrolled, all sons of Abraham's blood. Moses in Deuteronomy tells of God's holy deeds. Brave Joshua into Canaan's land the hosts of Israel leads." And so on, through all the books of the Old Testament. If this wasn't a very stimulating approach to sacred studies, at least it gave us a memory aid, destined to stay with us for years.
Let's take an old-fashioned walk.
Let's have an old-fashioned talk.
We will walk any place you choose to.
Let's talk about the things we used to.
Want a novelty in outdoor pastime, something for the real blasé. It's an old-fashioned walk
and an old-fashioned talk
with an old-fashioned girl someday. Let's take an old-fashioned walk.
Most classes grounded us firmly in fundamentals, and I remember that this was true of freshman English under a mousy little New England woman who taught us exposition by analyzing Huxley's A Piece of Chalk. Miss Myrick's relentless insistence on logical clarity made writing a theme a painful process, but it was a valuable lesson for which I am still grateful. I think she secretly sympathized with our sufferings, and, to make up for them, read us aloud her favorite poem, the typical New England story of Old Squire Ireson, for his hard, hard heart, tarred and feathered and carried in a cart by the women of Marblehead. Miss Myrick savored each word, but to us Carolinians the scene of the tale was so far away, the subject and accent so alien, that we sat through it unmoved. She must have thought our unresponsiveness one more evidence of Southern illiteracy. French was taught by Madame Rudnicka, ultra-Gaelic and sure beyond the shadow of a doubt that French culture, French language, French products, and French people were superior to their counterparts in the rest of the world. From her I learned a fact of life when I watched a notoriously poor student bring her lavish presents and receive good marks. At home I had absorbed my father's principles of academic integrity and assumed that all teachers were fair and honest. That this wasn't always true came as a jolt. There were other jolts, too. One night, when I turned down the covers of my bed, I found it full of salt put there by pranksters. Fortunately, I hadn't undressed yet, and was able to dump the salt in the trash can and go to sleep in comfort. Such doings were a well-known feature of boarding school life, and I think the perpetrators of this one were trying to practice some of the hijinks they had heard other gay spirits boast about. Quiet and studious by nature, I presented a good target. But I was too busy with other things to dwell on the incident. The school's two literary societies were active, and I found myself a member of Epsilon Alpha Pi, named for Edgar Allan Poe, in competition with Sigma Lambda, named for Sidney Lanier. Monthly meetings were conducted by the president in an awesome academic gown, and there were contests in writing, the planning and presentation of programs, and debates. In my senior year, I was to be president of the EAP, but before that, I was just an eager beaver working for the cause. We sang a song proclaiming allegiance to the society and honoring its patron in words that now seem a little odd to have issued from the lips of conventional young ladies. Come now and join in his praises. Live up to his good name. Inspired by Poe's own example, we're marching on to fame. The two societies took turns in supplying material for the monthly muse, and I was pleased when some of the stories I sent in saw the light of day in the EAP issues. Since St. Mary's was a church school, daily attendance at morning and evening prayers was compulsory. From the assembly hall in main building, we marched two by two in orderly procession to the little gray chapel, where we listened to the beautiful words of the Book of Common Prayer and absorbed age-old mysteries. When in my sophomore year Dr. Warren Way became rector, a new edict was proclaimed. Since it was improper for females to enter uncovered into the house of the Lord, caps were to be worn in the chapel at all times. Small triangles of black material were distributed to be sewed together to make beanies, a troublesome and rather messy procedure. My roommate Nina and I seized the opportunity and went into the business of making chapel caps and selling them at a tidy profit. Nor was the need merely temporary, for caps were constantly being lost and had to be replaced. In emergencies, strange substitutions were made: handkerchiefs, twisted scarves, ribbons and scraps of blotting paper. But such practices were frowned on by the authorities. Sometimes seasonal trimmings were introduced to relieve the drabness of the little black beanies. A sprig of holly before Christmas, and the first daffodil of spring. And at Easter, white caps were decreed. After the service in the chapel, we marched back to assembly to start the day's program with announcements by the lady principal. Prominently displayed on the wall near the front door was a huge chart with a square space for each student to enter a letter recording the fulfilled requirement for her daily exercise. G for gym, E for excused, and W for walking. This W referred to a certain number of walks around the path that encircled the large grove in front of the school. These circuits were measured in units, and we were honor-bound to record our fulfillment of the specified number. The daylight hours were well filled, and it wasn't easy to find time for such amenities as baths and shampoos. Not that these were as frequent as they are today. Bathtubs were limited, and you had to sign up in advance for a 10-minute period. If you forgot to do this, you could make your way down 2 dark flights of stairs to an old bathroom where the zinc tubs were 7 feet long and the taps supplied only cold water. Not a very comfortable arrangement, but it was rather fun to creep down the winding stairs into a forgotten era.
Is there still room for me beneath the old apple tree where there once was a bench for two? Oh, that bench wasn't long, and you know it wasn't strong when I sat there with you. I've got stairs back to Maine, and I'll jump on a train if your heart beats as hard and as soon.
I was too busy learning a new way of life to succumb to homesickness, but there were times when I ached with a feeling of aloneness. For separation from the world I had known, that of home and family, was complete. Letters came and went, but the 30 miles between Chapel Hill and Raleigh might have been 300 as far as contact went. Then, at Thanksgiving, my father came to see me. He made the trip by jitney, train, and streetcar to have dinner and spend the afternoon with me, and my joy knew no bounds. I must have been more homesick than I realized, for at the sight of his dear, familiar face, I almost burst into tears. Almost, but not quite. I had been taught to control my emotions, and this I did, trying to behave like a lady at any cost. I wonder now if it might not have been better to break down and let my father see how much I cared for him, and what his coming meant to me. But we were a reserved family, and never indulged in emotional display. I hope he knew, anyway, how glad I was that he had come. All this time, World War I was going on, and busy though we were with our own affairs, we at St. Mary's were trying to do our part. We bought thrift stamps, rolled Red Cross bandages, and planted victory gardens. We sang Tipperary, Over There, and Keep the Home Fires Burning, and almost swooned with sympathy when a tall, blonde French captain, dashingly handsome in his horizon blue uniform, spoke to us in the parlor, describing the sufferings of his countrymen, and sang the Marseillaise. When before dawn, on November 11th, 1918, we were awakened by bells and horns and the shouts of newsboys proclaiming the armistice, we jumped out of bed, snatched up the first coat we could find, and dashed down to the Grove to join in a hilarious snake dance. Then, just in time to catch the first rays of the sun, somebody raised the flag, and we stood with tears in our eyes while we sang the Star-Spangled Banner. Earlier in the fall, we had climbed through newly invented tanks on exhibit out at State College, and then the Spanish influenza had filled all beds in the infirmary and many in the dormitories before the school had to be closed while we recovered. But now we were back in business again, and trying to settle down to less eventful days. The previous winter I had seen a notice on the bulletin board telling of a scholarship to be awarded on the basis of competitive examinations. I'd always been a good student, and it occurred to me that I might have a chance of winning it. So, in May, when my friends sang, "Goodbye, school, we're through," and departed for home, I stayed on for 2 days, taking a battery of tests, all of which seemed fairly simple except one, my perennial bugaboo, math. This I failed, but the authorities gave me a second chance when another examination was held 2 months later. All summer I boned away at the hated problems, and finally passed the test and won the scholarship, which was worth $250 a year. This sum was more valuable then than it seems to us now, for the school's annual charges amounted to less than $400. My parents had given their consent when I applied for the scholarship, and they were pleased when I won, but they never made me feel that my efforts toward it were necessary or even important. This in spite of the fact that they were practicing rigid economies and denying themselves things they must have wanted very much. They just didn't talk about money. But I had sense enough to see how things were, and I was happy to be able to help out. The 3 years I spent at St. Mary's were valuable in many ways. Besides providing sound teaching, they bridged the gap between an extremely sheltered childhood and a more realistic adult world. I learned to take part in community activities, and even to excel in some of them. To be a big frog in a small puddle has its advantages, and though by today's standards St. Mary's was a very small puddle indeed, its limited size was, for me, a blessing. It gave me opportunities that would not have existed in a larger school, a chance to use to the full any gifts I had, and some I did not have, in writing, sports, and public speaking. As a senior, I played Orsino in Twelfth Night, debated that the Philippines should be independent, played jumping center on the Sigma First team, and loved it all. In none of these activities were my talents exceptional. I had a healthy body, a reliable mind, and the will to work. I learned by doing, and in the process gained much needed confidence in myself. There were other lessons learned the hard way. The school's strictest rule forbade students to leave the campus without permission, and when one Sunday afternoon some young friends drove up in an automobile and, after chatting with Nina and me, asked us to get in and go for a joyride, we accepted without thought of the dire consequences. Cars were still new enough to be exciting, and, as the authorities well knew, presented possibilities for disaster, physical and moral. Nina and I were naive enough not to realize the existence of such hazards, but we soon found out. The flagrant offense did not pass unnoticed. Summoned to the rector's office, we were made aware of its enormity, deprived of privileges, and made ineligible for honors. For a long period we were restricted, which meant that we could not put foot outside the school property. It was like having to wear a scarlet letter, a painful and humiliating experience. But it, too, passed. We survived, were reinstated in respectability, and went on to graduate in 1920, I as salutatorian of our class. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.
I think I wish and hear what I say. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.